Hello, and welcome to Blogging Heads Nation, Old Speechwriters Never Die, They Just Come Up With Creative New Careers For Themselves edition.
And gradually fade away.
but not for a long time, especially in your case, Chris. I'm Heather Hurlburt, Executive Director of the National Security Network.
And I'm Chris Brose, Senior Editor of Foreign Policy Magazine.
And our good friends at Blogging Heads had no idea of this, but the genesis for this event happened at a holiday party at Steve Clemens' house about 18 months ago now, where I was introduced to Chris, and I said, great, when you're finished writing speeches for Condoleezza Rice, let's get together and have a drink and compare notes. And this actually turns out to be our first opportunity to do that, Chris.
Exactly.
So we have a great thing to launch right into, which is President Obama gives a big speech tomorrow in Cairo.
That's absolutely right.
That's a venue that you're somewhat familiar with.
I've had a little bit of experience with regard to speeches in Cairo. I helped Secretary Rice write her remarks to American University of Cairo in 2005. So have a little bit of a sense of what this is like going through the process, as well as sort of how to shape something like this to the audience that Obama's going to be speaking to.
Did you do the 2007 trip as well?
Which one are you referring to?
She went back to Cairo in 2007, if I remember right.
She was there quite a bit.
yes.
I'm trying to remember if did it stand. I mean, was there something that she said or something that stood out from that? Or
I think this is as good a way as any to launch into our topic, because of course she gave that beautiful 2005 speech about democracy in the Arab world, which was tremendously well received and something that I think people cheered across partisan lines as a way of saying some things that desperately needed to be said about the Egyptian government and some other governments. And then she, in the way that Middle East policy worked, she found herself having to go back a number of times and talk about what a great partner the Egyptian regime was, which was a little one of the great challenges of how do you talk about human rights effectively.
Right. And I mean, this gets at the real difficulty of, you know, what Obama has to do. And I think that on the one hand, he has to, he has to speak to the people of these countries, and he has to let them know that America is on the side of their aspirations. He may decide not to do that, and I think that would be, you know, catastrophically dumb if he didn't. But, at the same time, you have to reassure these governments that you're going to continue working with them, and you need to continue working with them. And, you know, he has a very broad agenda, just as we did, from, you know, issues regarding Iran to Lebanon to Middle East peace. And you have to continue working with these governments at the same time that you make it clear that we're on the side of the aspirations of their people, which are not necessarily always in harmony with the behavior of the governments, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, which poses the interesting problem, because then is it true to say that I mean, in some sort of large notional way, we're on the side of the aspirations of their people, but in the specifics, we're actually generally not. We're on the side of stability and of the government staying in power and continuing to help us and so on and so forth. And I think one of the things that I always say when I teach speechwriting classes or give lectures about speechwriting is that one sits on a knife edge between what is and what ought to be. Mm-hmm. And the trick for a good speechwriter is to pick up enough of what ought to be to make a speech magical and resonant, but not so much of what ought to be that that you create something that just flat out isn't. And you know, the 2005 speech, you, Chris, in my preparation for this, I was checking out your very fun blog, Shadow Government, over at Foreign Policy.
Thank you.
And you have up a somewhat cranky post about, you know, why are all these people saying that Rice said that we wouldn't deal with the Egyptian government anymore, and why are people making us out to have been so hypocritical? And so I thought, well, gee, I should go back and look at that 2005 speech before I accuse Chris of being hypocritical. And, you know, when you look at it, you can see how, from the speechwriterly point of view, you and she tried very hard not to go over the edge. But when a U.S. leader goes to a country and says, this country must fulfill the promises it's made to its people, elections must meet objective standards, opposition groups must be free to assemble, that must coming out of the mouth of an American has a tremendous amount of power to it. And that, you know, to me is, I think, from all indications, the way that Obama is going to go at this is couching it very much in terms of his personal experience, which surrenders one kind of bully pulpit in favor of another, and very much the things that they've said going into this trip about trying to lead by example on democracy and human rights, which, you know, in some respects is going to be disappointing to those of us who've been longtime democracy and human rights advocates here, but may actually produce something better in the long run, because you can't, what you don't want is a speech that you can then look back and fault Americans for being hypocritical rather than fault the folks you were talking to for not picking up and making change in their societies.
I don't know. I mean, I would say a couple of things. You know, I think first, you know, there's this misperception that Secretary Rice went to Egypt and told them that they had to have an election, and that was not at all the case. Hosni Mubarak announced that Egypt was going to have an election, and this was, you know, or that I'm trying to remember now. I think it was that there was an election scheduled, and he announced that it would be competitive. And this is the great irony, is that, you know, there's been this kind of talk for a long time that all the Bush administration did was support elections, and that, well, elections don't really make democracy. Well, of course, everyone, I mean, nobody believes that, you know, you're going to have one election and a country is going to become democratic. But in most of these societies, most of these authoritarian countries, there are elections held. And elections are held because it's the tribute that vice pays to virtue. And even governments like Mubarak's Egypt or the Saudis feel that they have to have some semblance of elections, if only for their own legitimacy. You know, and there was a great article back in the Journal of Democracy by Tom Cruthers saying that most of the transitions to democracy that have happened in recent years have happened because of contested elections. People had an opportunity to come out to vote. The government tried to rig it, and they said, you know, we don't accept the results of this. So, you know, Condi Rice never told the Egyptians that they had to have an election. The Egyptians said that they were going to have an election. And Secretary Rice said that, well, if you're going to have an election, then you can't rig it. You know, you have to have competition, all sides. And this was a point of issue in the speech. And I remember working with this, working with her on this, that all sides had to accept the results. And all sides went for the people as well as the government. So, you know, I think that there was a lot of the speech was, in a sense, trying to set or vocalize some standards for what an election would be after the Egyptian government announced that they were going to hold one. But I do agree with you that the real tension is like you said, between sort of the world as it is and the world as you would like it to be. And that's where I think people, and you know, to some degree, I think the Bush administration played into this by emphasizing elections as a sign of success and giving the impression that we believe that elections were all that you needed for democracy. But you know, the Bush administration talked endlessly, and I wrote endlessly about how democracy was a generational process, that this was going to take a long time, and it wasn't just about elections. And, you know, with regard to a sort of lecturing or hectoring tone, you know, Secretary Rice went at it in much the same way that I imagine President Obama will, which is speaking from the experience of someone, you know, in her case, who spent a large part of her early life outside of American democracy and could speak very personally about the experience of someone who wasn't always a part of American society. And I think that at least that was the intention when we were working on the speech. This was a way to make some pretty hard messages go down a little bit easier, at least as far as the government was concerned. And I think as you suggested, the people ate this up. The question then is, you've set expectations rather high. Have you also developed a plan to fulfill them or to follow up? And that will be, to me, you know, kind of an interesting thing to watch with regard to the speech is, you know, rhetoric is great, but is there a plan of action that follows it out?
Yeah, I mean, that was very much my thought looking back at the 2005 speech, which actually is quite lovely for what it says about the American experience and how it grew to make sure that people like Secretary Rice were included in it. But you know, having said elections must meet standards, and then an election is held, doesn't meet standards in one of the top three recipients of U.S. aid, and there's pretty much no response. At the same time as an election is held in the West Bank and Gaza, which produces a pretty clear result, which we then reject after, as you said, all of this endless writing about democracy, and the Bush administration really hoisted itself on its own beautiful rhetoric, and that's the situation that Obama inherits, which I think, you know, is a very interesting problem for a for a speechwriter that you go into this situation with kind of one keyboard finger tied behind your back, in that you want to use the bully pulpit because, you know, Obama brings an incredible, I saw a t-shirt this morning which said, Obama, the new Tutankhamun for the world. Which I love the image of Obama in that King Tut headdress with the little,
exactly,
little golden scepter. But, you know, while you've got that bully pulpit, you need to use it. And I completely understand that the desire to go out and use it, and that you have seen a bounce in public opinion in the Arab world. And you do have this amazing personal story and the perception that he can go out and talk about Muslim life in America, which I think is an amazing thing, and which also, by the way, it doesn't get talked about very much. But the other thing that a speech like this does is, because there's so much news coverage of it, and you and I and everybody else incessantly chattering about it, it actually, right, results in the American public getting to know something more about global Islam and its many faces, which I think is incredibly helpful. For example, you know, how many Americans know that there are more Muslims in America than in, say, Kuwait or some other Arab country? You know, how many people know that about the richness and diversity of our own society, or the incredible, you know, relative success of how we live together? So, you know, people talk a lot about this speech having two audiences, the rulers and the ruled, across the world of Islamic peoples, but it's also got a third audience, which is the Americans, who,
no, that's absolutely
who,
right,
need, I think, a reset in, you know, how do we, what's the foundation from which we think about relations with Islamic countries? What's the foundation from which we think about what is and isn't possible? And that to me is at least as important as anything that different communities within the Islamic world pick up from this.
Well, it raises an interesting point with regard to, you referring to the Islamic world. He's spoken before of the Muslim world, and there have been a number of people. Scott Carpenter was writing on Real Clear World, I think, yesterday or the day before about this, that he should drop this entire idea of the Muslim world for a number of reasons. I mean, one, that it's patronizing; two, that it plays into the narrative of groups like Al-Qaeda that want to sort of lump all of these disparate societies together into sort of one meta-narrative of the Muslim world. And, you know, there have been a number of people who've said that he should just stop talking about the Muslim world entirely and refer to the citizens of individual countries or individual regions, that Islam in Indonesia is a very different thing than Islam in Saudi Arabia. What's your opinion of that? Should he speak to the Muslim world, or should he direct his message much more specifically?
I have to say I struggle with this one, because, you know, the points that critics of the phrase make are absolutely right. They're the Islamic peoples and Islamic nations are incredibly diverse. We don't have a good understanding of that in the U.S. One of actually the big mistakes that our policy has made in recent years is to lump different Islamic movements and peoples and countries together as if they were all, and, you know, as you say, completely feeding into the narrative that Al-Qaeda wants to create. And so at a policymaking level in particular, we need to be much more sophisticated and differentiated. And yet there is also, I think, a need for Americans to show that we understand, that we can understand profoundly, the idea that folks in Indonesia feel something about the plight of folks in Palestine or Bosnia or Sudan, that there is this greater sense of shared identity. And so I struggle a little bit myself with how to project that we understand that there is this sense of shared identity and a shared civilization that's incredibly rich, and that has enriched our own civilization in innumerable ways over the centuries. And so how we can talk about it in a way that reflects that there is a reality out there. It's just not the reality that Al-Qaeda is trying to create, or the sort of cartoonish, if, you know, they're not with us, they're against us reality that our own discourse has fallen prey to. So I would dramatically reduce but not entirely banish the phrase.
Yeah, I'm going to have to. I'm very much on the side of banishment. I would definitely just drop it and let it sort of go its way silently without making a big fanfare of it. Kind of like the global war on terrorism, I guess. You know, I think that it's you know, there are a number of problems with it aside from it being patronizing and sort of looking at people through the lens of, you know, identity politics as opposed to as individuals representing individual, you know, members of individual countries. And I think that, you know, it does really play into the narrative of Al-Qaeda, because so much of what you said, you're right. I mean, there are shared practices, shared customs, but there are also shared grievances. And I think with regard to that, the costs really do outweigh the benefits. And, you know, one of the things that I'm particularly concerned about is, yes, you have to, in a speech to the Middle East, to the Arab world, you have to speak about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But I think, you know, he, from sort of early indications, there's the sense that he is going to really make this front and center in his speech. And I think that would be a mistake. You know, I think that it again sort of feeds into this belief that we look at the region through the lens of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And it sort of feeds the assumption that if the Israeli-Palestinian conflict were resolved tomorrow, all of the other problems of the region would disappear. And I think that you can overstate this in the reverse, and I think the Bush administration did just this for its first few years in government. You know, the belief that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict just didn't matter, you know, that you get to Jerusalem through the road to Jerusalem leads to through Baghdad or whatever the phrase was. You know, I wasn't there at the time, but you know, I do think it sounds like, or it seems like, he might run the risk of falling right back into this trap that the sum all total of issues in the Middle East will be unlocked if the Israeli-Palestinian conflict can be resolved. And I think you set yourself up for disappointment on the one hand, because it's not going to be resolved in the near term. And second, it's just not true. And I don't think we should give the impression that that it is.
Well, I haven't seen the speech. I don't want to pretend to.
No, nor have I.
I don't want to pretend to knowledge.
Despite the many drafts that I sent them, they.
But I actually would be prepared to make a bet that when we do see it, if we look at the structure of it, it will be surprisingly similar to actually this. I mean, I happen to have just been looking at the Rice 2005 speech this morning, but my guess is that we could line up three or four or five sort of major speeches given by American leaders in the Middle East in the last, that Rice one, a couple of the Clinton and Albright ones in the last 8-10 years, and the structure will be fairly similar. That if you what'll be at the beginning will be the I'm Barack Hussein Obama. Let me tell you about my life as someone who lived in the Muslim world, who has Muslim family members, and yet who has had this utterly American experience that unfortunately, right, in many ways you can still have only in America, and that tells you something about me, but it also tells you something about the country that could elect me as its president. So you'll have that, and then you'll have the kind of obligatory how Egypt and Al-Azhar University and its glorious history stands as a symbol for the larger Islamic civilization. I'm going to try as a thought experiment how often I can say Islamic civilization instead of Muslim All right. world and see how that goes. And so you'll have that you'll have that theme. And then I think you'll have some stuff about the role of justice and the understanding of justice as a central tenet of Islamic thought, which is also, of course, a central tenet of American political thought and right. ideology. And then from that, you will sort of you will shift gears into a tour d'horizon that will include the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a prominent piece, but by no means the only piece. And mm-hmm. then when you get to that kind of around the region structure, which everybody who's been a speechwriter at the State Department has written more times than he or she cares to admit, as I said, I think if you line the speeches, you know, it'll have Israel-Palestine, it'll have Iraq, it'll have Iran, it'll probably touch briefly on Afghanistan, it'll say something to keep the Saudis calm. It will then either after or before, there'll be a sort of separate on terrorism and extremism, and you know, without I think using the phrase moderates, or which is another one of these sort of unfortunate divisions right. that sprung up in the rhetoric over the previous 8 years, attempt to make the argument, as you said, that we are more on the side of the vast, vast majority of Muslims than Al-Qaeda and allied extremist groups are. And that's a structure that the structure is actually going to look pretty familiar and be well within the mainstream of what constructive American attempts to engage the Middle East and Islamic countries more broadly have looked like over the last 10 years. So I actually think this idea that somehow there's going to be catastrophic over focus on Israel-Palestine is completely wrong.
Yeah, I hope you're right. I mean, we'll see. You know, going back to your point about sort of how you tackle this, I mean, the one idea that I had been kicking around a bit, and, you know, it was something that I'd thought a lot about after that speech during the time that I was still at the State Department, and really do think that, you know, if I had it to do over again, it might be the way that I, not to do over again, but if I were doing it now, the way I might approach it, you know, is you sort of look at the region right now, and it strikes me, I'm talking about the Middle East, you know, it strikes me that a lot of what is happening right now is just a sorting out of sort of how is influence going to be exercised and who is going to exercise it. And it's totally wrong to say, and, you know, I don't think many people would say, that we should be in the business of trying to deny countries influence in the region. You know, Iran, for example, is going to have influence in the region. It's a fact of life. The question, I think, with regard to Iran, with regard to Saudi Arabia, Egypt, but also the non-state actors like Hamas and Hezbollah, is what form is that influence going to take? And, you know, in this way, it really does, to me, it starts to look more and more like a kind of Helsinki process type approach, where you accept that countries have influence, and what you're trying to do is reach understandings about what form that influence is going to take. And that can be external influence with regard to, you know, we shouldn't be in the business of supporting non-state actors inside your neighbors who are destabilizing those countries or proliferating weapons across the region. You know, or it could, you know, it's internal influence, just as Helsinki was, with regard to how should a government treat its people. Can we agree on certain things that a government should and should not do? And, you know, there was an attempt in the Bush administration to do this through the Forum for the Future. So I think it was the Bahrain Declaration, which ultimately came to naught in many regards, I think, because of our good friends, the Egyptians or the Saudis. But it is this attempt to sort of lay out, you know, what is the kind of behavior that should determine the future of this region? And, you know, the United States is going to be a participant in that conversation, is going to shape it. But ultimately, it's up to the governments in the region as well. And I think something that could be very useful is for him to lay out possibly a set of principles or ideas about the kinds of behavior that we would think would be responsible and acceptable, that would liberate the talents of people in the region, that would be creative, and those that aren't, those that are destructive and are going to keep the region mired in a lot of the dysfunctionality that it's experienced for the past several decades and is going to be very destructive to its future. And I don't know, just a thought experiment, but it might be an interesting way to frame it. And you could imagine also, you know, a diplomatic process that could grow out of that, I guess.
Well, Chris, I don't. I actually spent the first 4 years of my career working at the OSCE, which is what the Helsinki process morphed into. And what I would find particularly attractive about that idea is, of course, that the Helsinki principles, as we know them, weren't one country's ideas. They were laboriously negotiated, and they entailed sitting down and negotiating and actually really making some compromises with countries that were our enemies in every sense, that they were negotiated between Americans and Soviets over time. And so, of course, really having a Helsinki process for the Middle East would involve sitting down with Hamas and Hezbollah and accepting some of their core concerns and Iran and Syria, some as well as the Saudis and the Egyptians and the Israelis and the Moroccans and so on and so on and so on, as well as our concerns. So actually the amazing thing about the Helsinki process, and what's so, you know, distressing about sort of the American political discourse on foreign affairs over the 33, 34 years since Helsinki, is that it was possible for Democrats and Republicans alike to agree that it was a good idea to sit down with the Soviets and even ultimately to compromise. And the Helsinki principles, which are regarded as such a strong, inviolate statement on human rights now, were regarded as really painful compromises on the U.S. part at the time, and there was a real question about whether it was morally acceptable, but we did it, and as you say, it worked out really well for us for the reasons you said. And so I would love to see an Obama administration able to go forward and say we would support convening everybody in the region and working through a set of shared understandings about the things that are most important to everyone in the region and getting our bottom lines, including our bottom lines on democracy and human rights, in there with other bottom lines. But I think that's a process that the American body politic is in no way prepared for, because of the level of you're with us, you're against us, there are good guys, there are bad guys, there are things we can never, never, never accept, there are countries that and movements that cannot legitimately have any influence that have you know grown up in American politics, not just over the last 8 years, but that were really profoundly deepened by the rhetoric after 9/11. So I'd love to see that. I wouldn't advise Obama to go out and start with it in month four, because the American body politic's not ready for it, and also, as you alluded to, the region's not ready for it.
But I think, I mean, this is where it gets back to the issue of Hamas and the election of the election that Hamas won. You know, again, there's the misperception, I think, that what the Bush administration, you know, did was sort of acquiesce to this election and then not accept the results. When, you know, I think what you could argue and what at least we thought or were arguing at the time was that we were making the demands, or we were expecting a set of behavior to result from that government that was elected that are the same standards that we hold every other country to, you know, that you shouldn't be in the business of declaring war on your neighbor and wanting to see it wiped off the map, that this isn't acceptable for anyone. And, you know, it sort of ties back into this question of, you know, some sort of a diplomatic process that would seek to establish ideas that would govern the behavior of you know countries and entities in the world. And it's not to say that the U.S. is going to have to sit down and have long conversations with Hamas, because I don't think that can happen or should happen or legally could happen. But there needs to be an understanding that if Hamas decided to become you know a political party that was going to exercise its influence in the democratic system peacefully, and recognize that Israel is an entity that's going to exist and that they're going to enter into a process to accept half a loaf of bread as the outcome, then everything would be resolved. I mean, there would be no problems there. And those are the only, those are the basic standards that we were holding Hamas to. And my understanding is that's the exact same standards that the Obama administration is continuing to insist upon. So it's not to say that, you know, some kind of a process like this is going to be a panacea or it's going to unlock everything. But it's the idea, I think, that, you know, you have to start tying together some of these, you know, aspects of behavior in the region and focusing not just on Hamas but also on Hezbollah and how, you know, entities like that will eventually relate to the countries in which they exist and exert influence. So I think, you know, you're right. I mean, maybe it's a reach too far, but it's the kind of idea that, you know, he doesn't have to say I'm announcing a bold new initiative today, but it's the idea that you start to sort of get at the kinds of behaviors that we as the United States government would like to see that, you know, we're not alone in wanting to see determine or define the future of the Middle East. And that, you know, you start laying out some principles of what that would look like. And it's not just, you know, like you said with Helsinki, it's not just the external behavior of states. It's how states relate to their own people.
Well, just to sort of circle back, since I think we're starting to butt up on the end of our allotted time, you know, why is Obama giving this speech in the first place?
That's a great
question. Why aren't
I thought he'd given it already.
Why aren't we going straight to the kind of big picture negotiations that you're talking about? And, you know, the reason is that there's a strong perception that the U.S. is not very well positioned right now to go out and say, well, our principles for how countries should behave and how countries should treat their citizens are X, and that there's a need to reestablish a foundation from which the U.S. is seen as having moral authority to do that. And the Obama folks, I think, have been very straightforward about seeing that as a first step on which they can build. And what I'm pleased about is that I was worried when there was so much emphasis for a while on, oh, we're going to go give a speech in the Muslim world, that that you have to be really careful about not using speech making, much as I love it, as a substitute for action.
Right.
But as what I think you will see is the ability to go in and say, okay, so here is my big rhetorical how we view the world and how we view the U.S. Interrelationship with Muslim civilization. And by the way, here's what we're doing with the Saudis. Here's what we're doing with the Iranians. Here's what we're doing with the Iraqis. Here's what we're doing with the Israelis. Here's what we're doing with the Palestinians. Obliquely, I think, here's what we're saying to Hamas and Hezbollah. You know, then there's the whole little matter of the Lebanese elections, which is another interesting challenge that we haven't touched on, but that is going to bring all the general things we've been talking about into very sharp relief next week when you see the Lebanese elect a government with Hezbollah in it. And
that's
how
right.
how do we deal with that? And how do you – so what I think you'll get is Obama trying to lay out what are American principles in a way that, you know, say, judge us by this, and that will return us to a point where you can imagine coming forward in 6 or 8 months and saying, okay, now the next step here is to try to get everybody else to think about some principles and what we can agree. So it's – they have concluded, I think, that there's a need – to reestablish the foundations first, and that's what this speech is about, and we'll see how that works for them.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch. You know, and I agree with you about the foundations, and this is, you know, in my own view, I think, you know, what I really hope he does do is not shy away from speaking about democracy and human rights. That you know, it's one interest of many that we have in the region. The United States government is not an NGO. We have a lot of interests that are often in contradiction with each other and in tension with each other. And, you know, I hope that he talks about that as a grown-up and treating his audience both in the region and back here in America as grown-ups. And this is getting back a little bit to what you mentioned earlier of my, you know, slightly peeved post from last night. But so much of this has been wrapped up in caricatures of various sorts or another, and it really masks a very hard and long-standing problem. And I, you know, I hope that he treats it with seriousness, and you know, the way that he's treated other subjects in his major speeches thus far. You know, and we'll just have to see. You know, he has been speaking a lot about how he wants to be honest with Israel, that this is, you know, he thinks honesty is a good thing. It'll be interesting to see if he is equally honest with some of his other audiences in the region, and you know, what form that honesty might take. But one way or the other, it'll be fun to watch, and also fun, I'm sure, for you, certainly for me as well, to know that we don't have to be a part of it, and that we haven't spent the past few weeks sleepless
yes.
and starving and near sick working on it, which was where I ended up at the end of the end of Secretary Rice's speech. So
yes.
Yeah, it'll be fun to watch, so we'll see.
Yeah, and for our next encounter, my agenda is sort of point one, how does this go? Point two, are you and I in our post-speech writing jobs part of the caricature problem or part of the solution? And point three, when is Secretary Rice going to be published in those photographed in public in those thigh-high boots?
For the record, public on what?
When is she going to be allow herself to be photographed in those kick-ass boots again?
Yeah, I don't know. Those were a one-time affair. I don't know what her plans for those boots are. And you know, I think the question might be, when am I going to be photographed publicly wearing those boots?
That is something for the Blogging Head audience to pray and hope and light incense to the deity of your choice for.
I have to pull back the camera here and give a little bit wider perspective. I'm sitting here in my office wearing those boots as we speak.
Great.
So it's anyway.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much,
you
Heather.
Too,
it's been really fun talking, and we'll do it again
yep.
soon.
Bye.